For Marx and for the genuine Marxist tradition, socialism is about human freedom. It is about building a society without class divisions and without oppression. And there can be no doubt whatsoever that Marx believed that such a society could only result from a revolution made by the working class, which sees the working class themselves take power. And for Marxists, any economy that is not based on working class democratic control would not be socialist. If you know anything about North Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, or any of the other authoritarian regimes that call themselves socialist or communist, like Mao's China or the old Eastern Bloc states, you'll know that none of these regimes have anything to do with democratic control by the working class. Therefore, we would argue they have nothing in common with socialism. And if these regimes were some form of socialism, it would be a major challenge to the validity of the socialist project. Socialism and human liberation would not be synonymous. They may in fact be incompatible. Having clarity on what these so-called socialist regimes actually are is therefore vital for defending the entire project of socialist revolution. Now, this starts with rejecting the erroneous equation of socialism with state control or state ownership of the economy. State control of industries is not socialism. Only working class control of industry qualifies. In China, Cuba, Vietnam, North Korea, workers never had any political control. They never controlled the state, and therefore state control of the economy does not equal working class control. What you have in these societies are unelected state bureaucrats running industries. They rule over the workers and exploit them to build up the state's capital stocks. The term for this is state capitalism. It is a system where the state acts as a giant corporation, hell-bent on accumulating capital. The working class is disempowered, subordinate, and exploited no less than any other capitalist country. And I want to turn now to explain how state capitalism came to be, these particular regimes came to be in North Korea, Cuba, and Vietnam. Now, the history of each regime is fairly distinct, but the commonalities are that not one of them was the product of a workers' revolution, and not one of them today involves democratic control by the working class. Now, let's start with North Korea. I'm going to spend the least amount of time on it because few people today actually hold this up as some sort of model for socialists to emulate. The North Korean state is unlike those which were created in Vietnam, China or Cuba. These other communist governments were created from anti-colonial revolts of the oppressed nations themselves. However, the North Korean state was not produced by any sort of revolution or guerrilla struggle by nationalist forces. Instead, it is the product, much like Russia's satellite states in Eastern Europe, it was founded by the USSR and the USSR's army at the end of World War II. And this is a fact emphasised by Kim Ha-yong, a Korean socialist, whose explanation of the origins of the North Korean state are as clear as any you'll find. And I quote, "Only one day after Nagasaki had been bombed, Japan announced its unconditional surrender to the Allies. With this, the Soviet Union, along with the US, was in a position to take Manchuria and the Korean Peninsula as war booty. When it came to the matter of dividing the war booty and deciding their zones of post-war influence, the hopes and aspirations of the people involved in the individual countries did not even enter the heads of the Allied leaders. After deciding on the division of Europe, Churchill asked Stalin, 'Might it not be thought rather cynical if it seemed we had disposed of these issues, fateful to millions of people, in such an offhand manner?' Well, Churchill's frank recollection shows just how cynical the Allies, including the Soviet Union, were about the wishes of the countries, the people of the countries involved. On the 28th of August in 1946, at the founding convention of the North Korean Workers' Party, Kim Il-sung read aloud a letter to Generalismo Stalin. 'Long live the great Generalismo Stalin, liberator, supporter, benefactor, and friend of the Korean people. The people of North Korea recognize that their liberation and development has been achieved only as a result of your affectionate consideration and the assistance of the Red Army.' Now, those socialists who look to the Eastern Bloc or to North Korea as socialist have clearly abandoned Marxism altogether. Rather than the working class needing to lead the struggle for socialism, socialism is now imposed on countries which were won by foreign armies as one of its spoils of war. And when you look at Eastern Europe, you see that workers resented these governments and made revolutions to overthrow them. Now let's move on to Vietnam. The Socialist Republic of Vietnam, so-called, emerged from the historic defeat of US imperialism in its war, which lasted until 1975. The US was eventually driven out of Vietnam and its neighbouring countries of Laos and Cambodia, but not before murdering between two and three million people. Revolutionary Marxists are opponents of imperialism, and we unconditionally support national liberation for oppressed nations, and hence we supported the resistance struggle led by the Vietnamese National Liberation Front. The defeat of American imperialism in Vietnam was a major victory for humanity. And one of its products, in addition to national freedom for Vietnam, was to create what was known as the Vietnam Syndrome. And this refers to a reluctance on behalf of the US establishment to wage major ground invasions and large-scale occupations in the decades that followed this historic defeat in Vietnam. And while we can support the National Liberation Front in their ultimately successful struggle to win national independence for Vietnam, any idea that this organisation was socialist is entirely bunk. Their leaders, such as Ho Chi Minh, were Vietnamese nationalists who were won to the counter-revolutionary politics of Stalinism. Ho Chi Minh joined the Communist Party as a student in France in 1924, and this was a time when the Communist International was being gutted of its revolutionary content. Within Russia, a new bureaucratic ruling class, led by Stalin, was usurping power. Stalin carried through a counter-revolution which dismantled what remained of working-class power, and the Russian Revolution was defeated. Stalin's cronies then transformed the communist parties of the world into agents of Russian foreign policy. They no longer played the role of struggling for workers' power, and in fact betrayed the revolutionary movements in a whole host of countries, such as China in 1925 to 27, and Spain in 1936 onwards. Now, the role of Ho Chi Minh's Vietnamese Stalinists were no less counter-revolutionary. By the mid-1930s, Moscow had adopted a policy known as the Popular Front. This was a strategy of making alliances between classes. And in practice, it meant subordinating the working class struggle to the politics of the so-called progressive sections of the capitalist class, of the bourgeoisie. And at the time, Vietnam was a French colony. In 1936, a Popular Front government came to power in France, backed by the French communists. And this capitalist government had no intention of granting independence to France's colonies. And this prompted the Vietnamese Stalinists to cease their agitation for national independence. But Ho's Stalinism went even deeper. While the Indochinese Communist Party was unwilling at this time to lead a struggle either for socialism or national liberation, there was a combative working class movement which demanded both. And this movement was increasingly coming under the influence of the Vietnamese Trotskyists. A report by French security police in February of 1937 noted, and I quote, "The influence of the revolutionary agitators favourable to the Fourth International, that is the Trotskyists, has grown, particularly in the working class milieu of Saigon." In July 1937, it added, "The worker element has been won more by the Trotskyist party than by the PCI, the Stalinists." These Trotskyists saw that the struggle for national independence ought to be led by the working class, as only the working class can be relied upon to consistently fight imperialism and also to achieve social liberation for the working people of that country. And leading Trotskyist Ta Thu Thao stated, "The question of independence must be merged with that of the proletarian revolution. The choice independence or slavery now poses itself in another more concrete form, socialism or nationalism." Until 1937, the Vietnamese Trotskyists and Stalinists operated in a united front. They stood, for instance, a combined slate of candidates for municipal elections in Saigon. But under orders from Moscow, the alliance was broken by Ho. The matter under debate was what attitude to take to the French Popular Front government. The Trotskyists controlled the newspaper La Lutte, which criticised the French government. And for opposing the colonial authorities, Ho labelled these Trotskyists as fascists. In 1939, he declared in a report to the Communist International, and I quote, "No reconciliation or concession is possible in relation to the Trotskyists. They must, by all means, be unmasked as agents of fascism, they must be politically exterminated. And ultimately, Ho saw to it that the working class militants grouped around the Trotskyists were exterminated, not just politically, but physically. When the Japanese were driven from Vietnam at the end of World War II, Ho Chi Minh supported the restoration of French rule. Stalinist hitmen collaborated with British and French troops in killing off the Trotskyists, who were leading a workers' revolt against the French. Now, Ho eventually did lead a war of resistance against the French, whose occupation ended in 1954. This was then replaced by the US occupation of South Vietnam, where American troops propped up a series of monstrous puppet dictators. Now, while we welcome the defeat of the US in Vietnam, there was nothing approaching a workers' revolution which led to that defeat. The politics of the NLF was not based on working class self-emancipation. They had literally killed off the people who based the struggle for national liberation on working class self-activity. The Vietnamese Stalinists won a guerrilla war and established themselves as the new ruling class. As for Vietnam today, only the willfully blind would fail to see that it is a class society. Vietnam is integrated into the world capitalist system. In 2007, it became a full member of the World Trade Organization. It operates export processing zones, like those found in China or Mexico, where foreign companies are free to exploit sweatshop labour. In April 2008, the BBC reported the following. More than 20,000 workers at a factory in Vietnam that makes shoes for Nike have gone on strike demanding higher pay to cope with rising inflation. The average monthly salary at the Taiwanese-owned plant is about $59, $59 a month, which is actually well above the minimum wage. Now, when Josh Lee stated some basic facts about capitalism in Vietnam in our Socialist Alternative magazine last July, it provoked an angry response from the Revolutionary Socialist Party, a small socialist, small Stalinist organisation here in Australia. Their paper opined that if Vietnam was characterised by all the excesses of capitalism, then surely this would include, and I quote, gross, conspicuous overconsumption by multi-billionaires, multi-million dollar bonuses for bankers who lose billions, widespread Ponzi schemes that deprive workers of what they need to live in old age, participation in military alliances or invasions to enforce capitalist order in other countries, multi-billion dollar companies going bankrupt because they didn't bother to notice what was wanted on the market, and tens of thousands of people in a country's larger city being homeless even though they have regular jobs. Now, to be honest, I'm not actually sure that there are Ponzi schemes in Vietnam. However, the existence of this particular obnoxious financial instrument didn't much feature in Marx's definition of capital in either of the three volumes of Das Kapital. The other assertions are frankly moronic. The Vietnamese regime engages in military alliances just like any other state. In fact, they, along with the other so-called socialist states of Cuba and Venezuela, gave strong and vocal support to the genocidal war that was waged against the Tamils by the government of Sri Lanka. 10,000 Tamils were killed by the government in the final weeks of that conflict last year, and over 150,000 were detained in concentration camps. The Asia Tribune, on the 21st of May last year, reported, Vietnam's foreign affairs spokesperson, Lee Dung, has said, Vietnam welcomes the recent victory of the government and the people of Sri Lanka. This victory will create favourable conditions for Sri Lanka to concentrate on the cause of national construction and development, contributing to peace, stability and development in the region. So talk about an alliance to enforce capitalist order in other countries. Pol Pot and Stalin are dead, and the RSP are finding new ways of linking the concept of socialism with genocide. Now, the rest of the RSP's assertions amount to claiming that Vietnam is not characterised by gross economic inequality. Well, I know this to be a lie, not purely through research, but just from having visited the country as a tourist. There is homelessness in Ho Chi Minh City. There is begging, there is unemployment, there is prostitution, there is police corruption, and if you spend a few days there, you'll see all of the above. There is certainly gross, even more than those things in some ways, there is certainly gross overconsumption. There are huge sections of the city where all the shop stock, Gucci, Prada, Louis Vuitton, and so on. There are entire malls where you couldn't buy a pair of shoes for less than $350. The owners of the sweatshops that make Nike trainers, they do not dine on hawker food, and they do not stay in backpacker accommodations. There are enormous luxury hotels where the price of a room ranges between $400 US and 1500 US dollars. Enormous hotels. All the guests drive luxury European cars. And down on the street, you will see amputees begging for change. You will see children out all hours of the night selling cigarettes, gum, knock-off copies of A Lonely Planet. I would say the inequality that exists in Vietnam today is extreme and really quite moving. Now, the RSP is a small split from the DSP, the Democratic Socialist Perspective, which runs the Socialist Alliance. And the latter are probably the most prominent standard bearers of Australian Stalinism. The DSP actually invites representatives of Vietnam's ruling Communist Party to attend their conferences. And I think this illustrates that the issue of how the left characterises the Stalinist regimes is still a relevant one. We in Socialist Alternative do not consider the ruling class of Vietnam as our comrades. Our solidarity does not go out to the dictatorship, but to the working class militants who bravely organise independent labour unions, which are illegal under Communist Party rule. So that's Vietnam today. But was it ever different? Well, in the first 10 years of the existence of the new Vietnamese state, there existed a state-run economy, and the move towards encouraging foreign investment began in 1986. Before then, there were no Nike sweatshops. Vietnam in those years was like a plethora of countries that gained independence in the decades after World War II. These regimes more often than not adopted the rhetoric of socialism or communism. And this was true of China, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Egypt, China, Cuba, and so on. And some of these new regimes were run by communist parties. But even where they were not, such as Nasser's Egypt, you still had a very high level of state ownership within the economy. And this is because these countries have been kept backward economically by the colonial powers. The new nationalist regimes wanted economic growth and development so their country could, have a real place within the world system. It has to be understood, however, that most foreign direct investment happens between the rich countries. And also the local capitalist class was quite, on a comparative scale, quite small and quite weak to lead proper economic development. So private capital, either foreign or local, it was deemed was sort of unreliable when it came to investing sufficiently to let these nations catch up to the developed world. Yet there was a model in existence that these third world nationalists could look to. It is an example of an economically backward country that became a military and economic power. And that model was Stalin's Russia. When Stalin implemented his first five-year plan in 1928, Russia had long been one of the most backward countries in Europe, but it was certainly a pretty devastated and backward economy. And by the end of World War II, Russia had been transformed into a world superpower, second greatest world superpower. Now, to achieve this, Stalin used the state, and not just any state, but a brutal authoritarian state that militarised labour, that banned unions and strikes, that established forced labour camps, starved peasants to fuel industrial development, and so on. Well, for Marxists, all ideas have a class basis. They represent the interests of a certain class. Marxism itself represents the interests of the international working class. It should be clear, I think, that the Stalinist project of state capitalist development was not an idea to advance the interests of the working class. Instead, the class basis of Stalinism is the bureaucrat and the middle-class intelligentsia. Stalin appealed to the nationalism of the underemployed intelligentsia of the Third World, and Tony Cliff explained why this was the case. The intelligentsia is sensitive to their country's technical lag, participating as it does in the scientific and technical world of the 20th century. Given the general economic backwardness, the only hope for most students is a government job, but there are not nearly enough of these to go around. These intellectuals are privileged beyond the majority of the people, yet subordinated to foreign powers, to foreign rulers. They experience a feeling of guilt, of debt to the dark masses, yet at the same time a feeling of divorcement from them and of superiority to them. They are in search of a dynamic movement which will unify the nation and open up new broad vistas for it, but at the same time will give themselves power. They hope for reform from above and would dearly love to hand the new world over to a grateful people rather than seeing the liberating struggle of a self-conscious and freely associated people result in a new world for themselves. Thank you. They care a lot for measures to drag their nation out of stagnation, but care very little for democracy. They embody the drive for industrialisation, for capital accumulation, for national resurgence. All this makes totalitarian state capitalism a very attractive goal for intellectuals, and indeed they are the main banner bearers of communism in the emergent nations. I want to look now to Cuba. Cuba's Communist Party government has more prestige, I think, amongst leftists internationally than the other Stalinist regimes, such as Vietnam and North Korea. And there are several reasons for this. The Batista government, which was overthrown in the revolution of 1959, was a corrupt US-backed government. Batista ran Cuba as a haven for US companies and the mafia, and his overthrow is certainly to be welcomed. Ever since, Cuba has had to stand up to aggression from the United States, such as the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion of 1961. The US still maintains a harsh economic embargo on Cuba, which punishes its people. Now, we in Socialist Alternative oppose all attempts by the US to interfere in Cuban politics. The US has no right to bully other nations or to try to force its policies on other countries. And we derive this stance from our opposition to imperialism, not, however, from some faith that Castro represents socialism. Cuba gets a lot of good press for its extensive healthcare system, and obviously we defend all elements of the welfare state that exist in Cuba, just as we defend the public health and welfare systems such as they still exist elsewhere in the world. The right wing of the United States seems to consider any public spending on health and social welfare as amounting to socialist dictatorship. I think this just indicates, though, how right-wing and loony they are. If it were correct that, you know, any sort of state spending on health or welfare amounts to socialism, then socialism, comrades, prevailed a long time ago in Australia, Britain, Canada, and most of Western Europe and elsewhere. Public health and welfare systems can supplement a capitalist economic order, but they do not mean the abolition of that order. And while Cuba lacks Nike sweatshops and is not part of the WTO, we can wonder, though, does that have more to do with the fact that the United States actively prevents Cuba from integrating into the world economy in the way that the Vietnam, for instance, has? However, there are clearly elements of clear-cut capitalism, out-and-out exploitation and class inequality that the Cuban state does actively promote. For instance, it has encouraged the development of foreign-only tourist resorts, luxury resorts for wealthy foreign tourists. And locals are prohibited from entering those resorts, going onto those beaches, unless, of course, they've got low-paid jobs as servants and cleaners and so on. The other factor, I think, that endears the Cuban revolution to many people is the romanticised image of the guerrilla fighter, heroically battling with gun in hand. But I think it has to be understood that the politics of guerrilla warfare are not the politics of socialism. Socialism rests on the social power of the working class. Because the labour of the working class is central to the profit system, it is central to the functioning of the modern capitalist society, workers can not only disrupt capitalist business as usual, but take over the means of production and begin reorganising the economy along democratic lines to meet human need. That's the politics of socialism. With guerrilla struggle, however, the centre of struggle is in the countryside, not the city and not the workplace. The urban working class does not lead and, in fact, cannot really participate. A guerrilla army gets most of its fighters from the ranks of the peasantry, but only a small fraction of the peasantry ever participates. These peasant fighters are subordinated to their military officers who are drawn from the urban intelligentsia. And should the guerrilla warfare be victorious, it is these officers who are in a position to take power, not the mass of people. And by the time of Batista's fall, Castro's army consisted of just over 800 fighters, largely from peasant backgrounds. As Che Guevara explains, this army created in the countryside, where subjective conditions ripen for the seizure of power, proceeds to conquer the cities from outside. In fact, Che believed the very existence of an urban working class gets in the road of revolutionary change. He wrote, "It is more difficult to prepare guerrilla bands in those countries that have undergone a concentration of population in great centres and have more developed light and medium industry. The ideological influence of the city inhibits the guerrilla struggle." Okay, so this perspective could not be more opposed to Marx's views. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels wrote that by developing an industrial working class, the capitalists are producing their own gravediggers. But even where a working class does exist, unfortunately for Shea, he still believes that it's right to ignore them. He wrote, "Even in countries where the predominance of the cities is great, the central political focus of the struggle can develop in the countryside." So this is very much a rejection of Marxism, as the central idea of Marxism is that the working class is the agent of revolutionary change. Castro's rise to power has nothing to do with the working class fighting for liberation. It was a nationalist revolt carried out by guerrillas supported by a network of urban saboteurs. The kind of society, what kind of society did the leaders of this guerrilla army wish to build? Well, Castro's July 26 movement desired industrial development in which the private sector could flourish. They saw the US and its puppet regime as a barrier to this development, and therefore it needed to be overthrown. In February 58, Castro stated, "I've personally come to feel that nationalisation is at best a cumbersome instrument. It does not seem to make the state any stronger, yet it enfeebles private enterprise. Even more importantly, any attempt at wholesale nationalisation would obviously hamper the principal point of our economic platform, industrialisation at the fastest possible rate. For this purpose, foreign investments will always be welcome and secure here." Castro was a self-described anti-communist. The Cuban Revolution was only described to be socialist retrospectively, more than two years after it happened. And this change in rhetoric reflected the fact that the US had decided to punish the new nationalist regime in Cuba. And this cut off Cuba from the main market for its export, which is sugar. Cuba quickly became dependent then on the USSR, which offered aid, seeing a kind of strategically important post, only a few miles off the coast of Florida. Russia took up buying Cuban sugar and basically subsidised the Cuban economy through cheap oil. So out comes the Marxist phrasebook. Now, Che Guevara is often presented as the more left-wing figure in the revolution. Now, partly this is a matter of image, that while Castro got incredibly old and appallingly verbose, Che died young and pretty, like a revolutionary James Dean. It should also be pointed out that whereas Castro vocally rejected Marxism until 61, Che had identified himself with Marxism before the revolution happened. But I would argue that it is amongst the would-be Marxists within the Cuban revolutionaries, people like Che and Fidel's brother Raul Castro, these people were the most distinctively anti-working class elements. The reason is that the Marxism that they spoke of was not about forwarding the struggle of the working class against capitalism. No, what Marxism meant to them was simply promoting industrial development and economic diversification at all costs. For Che, Marxism meant precisely that. And it's these, the state playing a role in achieving these things. So these would-be Marxists hoped that Cuba would soon produce a broader range of goods than just sugar. And this was to be achieved by reductions in working class living standards and encouraging workers to work for free on their days off, the so-called voluntary labour days that Che introduced. Now, looking at Che's economic policies is also a great way of understanding why states like Cuba should be seen as specifically capitalist. You have an economy subject to international competition. The people who control the Cuban economy are trying to stop foreign companies from dominating their market. Now, to do this, they need to accumulate some industrial capital. Accumulation of capital happens through the exploitation of workers. The bosses, in this case state officials, have to drive workers to work more intensely and work for longer hours to accumulate more wealth to compete with their overseas rivals. Now, Marx once wrote of a society in which workers were exploited so that bosses could accumulate more capital and compete with their rivals, and he called it capitalism. And in fact, he wrote a 3-volume book on the matter. Cuba is not a democracy of any description, let alone a workers' democracy. Since the 1970s, there have been elections for this thing called the National Assembly. However, there is only one candidate allowed to stand per seat. And these candidates are selected by a committee comprising of members of the Communist Party and their various organisations. And in any case, it's not an actual parliament. It only meets for like twice a year, and it doesn't make any actual decisions. It simply elects the cabinet, which each time consists of Fidel Castro and several other members of the Communist Party Central Committee. But not to worry. We're told that the masses are invited to participate in institutions like the Committee for the Defence of the Revolution. But the CDRs are not decision-making bodies. In fact, most of the role they play is helping to transmit the goals of the state to the community, and also play a role in bullying and spying on dissidents. The Cuban government regularly represses dissent, whether in the media, by political activists, or by artists. There is little free debate in Cuba, let alone democracy. And even more crucially, there are no independent labour unions, only state and party-run unions. And what's their job? Well, Raúl Castro described the principal tasks of these unions are to help the management with the productivity and work discipline, the more efficient utilisation of the workday, and more efficient and rational use of material and human resources. It should be mentioned that strikes in Cuba are illegal. Now, to call this situation a worker state is an insult to language, let alone the working class. Women, blacks, gays and lesbians all suffer oppression in Cuba, just like in the West. Castro's Cuba has a deplorable record of homophobic oppression. Castro stated that gay men do not embody the conditions and requirements of conduct that would enable us to consider him a true revolutionary. In 1965, Cuba began its first program of sending gays to concentration camps for re-education. From 1974 to 78, gays were banned from working with children. They were also banned from joining the Communist Party for most of its existence. In 1979, a law decreed that public displays of homosexuality were subject to a jail term, and so on. Now, since then, Cuba has granted a number of legal reforms, such as you know, those that were won perhaps a little bit earlier in other countries, in a number of other countries in the world, such as in 1988, they decriminalised homosexuality. But still, the Cuban government's response to the HIV-AIDS crisis in the 1980s was brutal and homophobic. Everyone who tested positive for HIV was locked up in a concentration camp. And these policies, as some of Cuba's defenders would say, they're not just relics from the past. I mean, for one thing, the revolution did win in the 1950s. Oppression in Cuba exists because exploitation continues. It is important to recognise this because many people reject Marxism on the basis that if these regimes were socialist, then socialism clearly does not liberate gays and lesbians or women or so on. But when you compare Cuba with a real workers' revolution, you see that Marxism is right. In Cuba, workers never had power, so homophobic oppression continues. In Russia, where workers did take power in 1917, homosexuality was decriminalised within 2 months. In fact, all state restrictions on relationships, sex and reproduction were abolished. Same-sex marriage was a right that was granted. Sex change procedures were funded by the state. Abortion was legalised and freely available, and so on. And this was over 90 years ago. And this proves that only the working class can liberate humanity. And only situations where the working class takes power for itself can be considered socialist. Well, I want to turn finally to the question, does it matter that there is no socialist country that we can point to in the world today? That there is no sort of ready-made model of socialism we can sort of pull out and say, hey, here's one that we prepared earlier. Well, I think that rather than place false hope in these authoritarian regimes, we should instead get our hope and inspiration from all of the times when the working class has engaged in revolutionary struggle in the last 130 years. We should look as a model to the organisations that workers themselves set up. The workers' councils, for instance, that were established in 1905 in Russia, in 1917 in Russia, and in countless revolutionary struggles since. Grassroots democratic institutions whose power was based on at the point of production, where workers elected delegates to actually take charge of the running of society. This is the kind of model that we should actually look towards. And in Russia, you can see the achievements of it. The things about sexual liberation that I've already mentioned. But the fact as well that the Soviet government there ended Russian involvement in World War I, ended that imperial slaughter. The fact that freedom to secede was granted to all of the nations oppressed by the Russian Empire. That this new Soviet government was able to create a red army, an army of the working people that was able to defeat the fascist white army and also repel the invasion of 14 imperialist countries. Huge achievements by the revolutionary working class. But it's not just Russia. In fact, a lot of the same countries where you had a successful guerrilla struggle to supposedly impose socialism, a lot of these same countries, you have a rich tradition of working class struggle. And it's important that we understand this. So, for instance, in Cuba, the Mikado dictatorship was overthrown in 1933 amidst a general strike by the working class of Havana. That is important to realise. And that struggle led to the creation of embryonic workers' councils and experiments in workers' control of production. That was a struggle, incidentally betrayed, famously by the Cuban Communist Party. In China, another country where you had a guerrilla struggle and a Communist Party dictatorship, in 1925 to 27, you have a workers' revolution where in Shanghai, in Hong Kong, in the eastern parts of China, where they set up workers' councils. They set up something which was described as government number two, that the workers set up themselves. There is this alternative to Stalinist dictatorship, and there always was. And in fact, workers courageously built alternatives themselves, revolutionary alternatives, even when they were under the heel of the kind of monstrous dictatorships in places like Eastern Europe. If you look at the fantastic struggle, one of the greatest working class revolutions ever was 1956 in Hungary, where the working class in its entirety rose up to resist the dictatorship there and fight back against the imposition of Russian domination. It's ultimately defeated by an overwhelming force of arms by the Russian state, but an incredible taking over of all the institutions of society to try to win freedom, and this was a working class revolution. So there always is and there always has been an alternative to Stalinism, and that alternative is the power of the working class and its ability to take over production and to set up democratic institutions run by the working class itself, and that is what we look to. And actually, those moribund political organisations that still look to and promote as a model Vietnam, Cuba, North Korea, those people who still think that the Eastern Bloc or Mao's China or Stalin's Russia were some form of socialism, their politics gets in the road. They are a barrier to understanding the kind of strategies that we need to take the struggle of the working class forward. Thank you.